Okay, yes, the debt limit, but there was more to the week in this economy than just that, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 20th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a whole lot of political about this economy in the air this week, and we will give that a nod. But before we do, there are some economic nuts and bolts we got to get to, so we will. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Jordan Holman is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Jordan, let me start with you. You cover retail for the New York Times. I would like you to address, please, the decline in retail sales in this economy in the month of December, down 1.1%. Discuss.
Yes. So retail sales in December, that decline was the fastest of 2022. And it did fall on top of a decline that we saw in November. So we are seeing a trend down of shoppers pulling back. And yes, inflation did ease during that time, but you saw like a drop of department stores dropped 6.6%, showing that people are like really holding back on what they're spending, which is also a bit troubling because December is the clear lead up to the holiday season. Right. So lots of analysts I spoke with this week said, expect that to continue, especially since January and February. That's a really slow time in retail after the holiday blitz.
Is it possible, Catherine Rampell, that after literally years of consumers in this economy being the bulwark, if you will, of economic challenge, that consumers now are finally like, you know what, inflation's going down, but we've been getting beat up for a year and a half, and I'm out, right? Have we cracked the American consumer, do you think?
I don't know that we've cracked the American consumer. I mean, consumers are still the engine of the U.S. economy. The question is, are they spending quite as enthusiastically as they had been before? And I think there are a couple of reasons why their spending spree, our spending spree, might be, if not petering out, you know, moderating a little bit, including the fact that people are spending down their savings. Part of the reason why spending had been so strong for so long is that people had accumulated a ton of savings, both from being sort of locked down and cooped up and not going out and dining out, traveling, et cetera. They had a lot of savings from that. They had savings also from government transfer payments, you know, the stimulus checks and other kinds of fiscal aid that went out. And for a lot of people, their assets went up, right? The market was rising, their house was getting more valuable, so they felt a little bit more flush. So some of those things are reversing right now. And besides, you know, like a lot of the big ticket items that people were buying, you don't buy that frequently, right? These are durable goods, things like a refrigerator. If you already bought a refrigerator a few months ago, chances are you're not in the market for one again. So, you know, I think that people have been predicting for a really long time, like at the very least, durable goods spending was going to slow down because the, by nature of the fact that it's durable, people don't need to like purchase it over and over and over again. But consumers, you know, are still way above trend from before the pandemic, to be clear, just not growing as quickly as had been the case.
Jordan, do you think retailers are not regretting, but sort of worried about inflation more now than they were? I mean, yes, it's on the decline. And yes, retailers and many, many companies used inflation as a way to increase prices and thus increase their margins. Are they now probably bracing for worse times ahead, do you think?
Yes, I think the assumption is like this first part of 2023 will be slower when it comes to shopping. But I think the point that Catherine made was a very good one in terms of you're not going to buy a refrigerator again. But a lot of retailers did plan as if you are going to, that shoppers were going to keep buying those big things. And so then they bulked up their businesses. So now I think it is also a recalibration in the retail sector about what is a reasonable or normalized baseline for shopping. And so that's some of the growing pains that are happening right now and that retail execs are kind of scratching their heads about what is the American shopper going to look like.
Right. Okay. Change of topic, Catherine. I want to talk about the Fed for a minute. I want to talk about their messaging challenge now as inflation does seem to have peaked. And the public split in what some voting members of the Federal Open Market Committee, some are saying, including Christopher Waller today, said, you know what, I'm in favor of a quarter percentage point this next meeting at the end of this month. Others are saying, you know what, we got to keep rates high and just beat this thing into the ground. How big do you think the Federal Reserve's messaging challenge is right now?
I think it's really difficult. Almost any choice that they make, it's not just about messaging, it's also about the actual policy actions that they take, because almost any choice that they take is going to be sort of the wrong choice, right? Or at least it carries huge risks. Because on the one hand, yes, you're right, inflation has peaked, or it seems like it has peaked, but it's still high, right? It's still higher than their targets, than their long-term targets. You know, on the other hand, it's come down quite a bit, and they don't want to like overshoot and kill the economy. You know, they don't want the medicine to kill the patient, essentially, by raising rates too much. So, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place, and they're getting criticism from both directions, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've already seen a number of Democratic lawmakers, for example, criticizing the Fed for previous rate hikes, saying that they were too aggressive and that that was going to harm the economy. And then meanwhile, people are still frustrated about the elevated inflation we have, even if it's not quite as bad as it had been. So it's challenging, I think, for them to figure out what to do and then how to explain what they are doing and why they are doing it, given the uncertainty ahead.
Jordan, do you think and this is kind of a random question, but do you think the general population that listens to this program or reads the business pages of either one of your newspapers appreciates the dilemma the Fed is in?
That's a great question. I mean, I think they would appreciate it if the Fed doesn't land the plane properly.
Yeah.
Like it is this balancing act. I think the thing that Catherine was talking about, like weighing the options that the Fed has right now, obviously shoppers just want to see lower prices. But if you stop the process too soon, they might not see that down the line. So I think they could appreciate the process, but maybe the results would matter more.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. All right, Catherine, last question to you. We've got 45 seconds, which is a challenge with a question of this nature. But let me ask you this. I was talking to Sudeep and Kate last Friday about the debt limit and whether they thought it was going to be resolved. And they both, on a scale of 1 to 10, they both said, yeah, about a 5, I think it's going to get fixed. They said the economic imperatives are clear. So the same question to you. Do you think it's going to get resolved? And discuss, please, if you would, the political imperatives around this conversation this time, which I think are different than the last time we're having it. And you can take a full minute. Go ahead.
Sure. I hope it gets resolved. I very much hope it gets resolved. In the past, yes. In the past, you know, there had been this brinksmanship that in the end, everybody backed down and said, okay, we really don't want to default. I am not as confident that things will work out as smoothly this time. Markets seem to be pretty complacent, but I think that they're too complacent in my view, because the makeup of the Republican Party has changed a lot since the last time we went through this kind of episode. And there are more fringe members who might be, you know, demanding their own ransom for raising the debt limit. And even these kinds of off ramps that have been proposed, you know, there's this complicated thing called a discharge petition.
Oh, yeah.
That would require a lot of legislative time. Basically, they'd have to get started on that today, and it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So I think that there are a lot of ways this could go wrong. I very much hope it doesn't, but I'm quite worried this time.
If Catherine Rampell's worried, I'm worried. I'll tell you that. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Jordan Holman is at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, well, tell you what, I'm going to give you a little housing number first, because Amy Scott's going to have a housing story coming up in a couple of minutes. Before we get there, though, the latest real estate data point from the National Association of Realtors this morning came their regular report on existing home sales. Down again in December over a year ago, off 34%. That wrapped up the worst year in that sector since 2014. The December drop, by the way, the 11th month in a row of falling existing home sales. Now, on Wall Street, pardon the head fake, shares prices were not falling. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Well, One of the many trends in this economy we've all seen since the pandemic started is the worker shortage. People staying on the sidelines because they can or because they have to. Also, though, a drop in immigration. Immigrants have been the lion's share of labor force growth in this economy for years, and their absence is contributing to some of the economic challenges that we are having now. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Half the growth in the labor force since the year 2000 has come from immigrants, according to Mark Regetz, senior fellow at the National Foundation for American Policy.
They actually became more important during the pandemic. They have been all the labor force growth over the last 3 years.
But that labor force has stalled. Early retirement among Americans generally was one big cause. A fall in immigration was another.
We saw some restrictions on immigration during the Trump administration, but immigration really fell when the COVID-19 pandemic hit.
Julia Gillott is a senior analyst at the Migration Policy Institute.
And the number of legal immigrants coming to the United States fell by half between 2019 and 2020.
There are still backlogs in processing immigration applications, and there are still 10.5 million job openings for only 6 million unemployed people. Estimates vary on just how many potential workers the country lost because of the slowdown in immigration. Giovanni Perry is a professor of economics at UC Davis. He and a colleague tried to calculate it.
By late 2022, this number was about 1.7 million. We were missing 1.7 million immigrant in that working age group.
Mark Regetz says this gap contributed to the inflation we're seeing.
Inflation occurs when you have demand for goods and services growing faster than their production. Immigrants do buy things. They also do an awful lot to increase production, and that keeps inflation lower.
As recently as November, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that a drop in immigration had contributed to the tightness in the labor market. Recent data, though, show the situation may be easing. Again, Julia Gillott at the Migration Policy Institute.
We have seen both, you know, a recovery in legal immigration, people getting visas to the United States. We've also seen really high numbers of people coming across our southwest border who can get work authorization if they apply for asylum and wait for a certain period.
Inflows of refugees from Afghanistan and Ukraine have also added to immigration numbers. All of this together may, she says, compensate for the shortfall in workers the U.S. suffered during the pandemic. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, as promised, Amy Scott on housing now. There is a new and not great milestone in housing in this economy. Moody's Analytics is out with a new report that shows for the first time the average renter household in this country is paying 30% of its income on rent. The term in housing policy circles for renters in that situation is cost burdened. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into what that means in practice.
When Moody's started tracking housing affordability more than 20 years ago, the typical household spent about 23% of its income on rent. A decade ago, it was 26%. But at the end of last year, it hit 30%.
We are in a situation where this cost of shelter, a necessity to life, has continued to rise, and it is hurting households.
Thomas LaSalvia is director of economic research at Moody's Analytics. He says there are big geographic differences. The average in New York City is more than 68% of income. In Miami, about 42%. Alexander Herman is a researcher at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. He says when people have to spend so much on rent, they have less to save for a down payment to buy a house.
They're also spending less on food, less on school supplies, less on healthcare, clothes. Really, it means less left over for all other essentials.
Especially when so many of those essentials have gone up in price, too. Those who struggle with rent also may have to settle for less than ideal housing.
A crummier apartment, a house with less space, a neighborhood with worse schools that's further away from friends and family.
Herman says there's also been a big increase in severely cost-burdened households, those paying more than 50% of their incomes on rent. That's the case for Melissa, who lives in the Twin Cities and didn't want us to use her last name because of privacy concerns. She's paying $1,065 for a bare-bones studio apartment. She makes just over $23 an hour at a trucking company and had to take a second job delivering pizzas.
And I work somewhere between 50 to 20 hours on top of my full-time job.
Even then, she says she's cut back on pretty much everything.
I limit myself on streaming services. I don't go to movies. I shop at Aldi. Yeah, I don't go out much. I don't do things, a lot of things, a lot of the time.
That's hard on her. It's also money she's not spending in other parts of the economy. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It operates the same as any other bus. The thing is, it drives sort of like a golf cart.
The wheels on the bus go round and round electrically. Round and round. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 330 points today, 1%, 33,375. The NASDAQ picked up 288 points, about 2.75%. 11,140. The S&P 573 points to the good, 1.9%, 39.72. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow lost 2.7%. The NASDAQ gained almost 0.6%. S&P 500 went the other way, slipped 0.2%. Amazon Web Services is going to spend $35 billion American dollars over the next 20 years on its data centers in Northern Virginia. Amazon delivered 3.8% today, 37 million, of which I am one. That's how many phone accounts T-Mobile announced had their name, billing address, email, and phone numbers compromised in a data breach. The company said the cost of dealing with the breach would be, quote, significant. Share price is basically unchanged. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Lunar New Year starts on Sunday, a very big deal in much of East Asia. So big, in fact, that factory production stops for weeks while workers visit their families. And that usually has big implications for global supply chains. Thing is, ain't nothing about our pandemic economy global supply chains that is usual. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on that.
Businesses that import goods from East Asia are well aware that factory production tends to slow down this time of year, so they plan ahead.
If I know that I'm going to need some inventory in the beginning of the year, I try to make sure that I order that by the end of October.
That's Brandilyn Green. She runs a hair products company called Voice of Hair, and she gets a lot of her packaging from China. If she waits too long to order it, she says, she might be out of luck.
If you haven't gotten what you needed by the end of the year, you're probably not going to get it until like the second week of February.
But during the pandemic, that started to change. The past two Lunar New Years,
factories really didn't shut down as much just because there was this, you know, almost insatiable demand from the U.S. consumer.
That's Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University. As a result, he says,
we had very high imports in the United States in February and March of 2021 and 2022, which is a very non-seasonal pattern.
China's strict zero COVID policy also prevented many workers from going home to celebrate the holiday, says Phil Levy, chief economist at Flexport.
Horrible that they didn't get to see their families and return, but it did mean that the factories were operational when they often hadn't been in the past.
China has been loosening up its travel restrictions, so Levy says factory production will slow down again. But ahead of this Lunar New Year, he says importers haven't been ordering as much.
And I think the real culprit is that you've got companies with lots of stuff in inventory already, and warehouses in many places are pretty full.
Companies have also been getting less reliant on China in general, says Weston Labar, chief strategy officer at the freight broker Cargomatic.
Due to the Trump-era tariffs, and then also COVID shut down many of those manufacturing centers, and the zero COVID policies made it almost impossible to get them to open back up in a timely manner. And that forced even more shippers to look elsewhere.
Places like South America and West Africa. If that continues, Labar says the disruptions that tend to happen around Lunar New Year might not be as big of a deal. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Electric cars, we talk about all the time. Electric trucks, well, they're coming. Electric transit buses are in some cities already. And electric school buses, though, not really, even after the first one hit the road in California way back in 2014. Mostly, it's because they're expensive. New e-school buses, or school e-buses, take your pick, can run as much as $350,000, 2.5 times a diesel or gas model. But more of them are starting to hit the road thanks to some new funding that's out there. From WBUR, Kara Young went to Beverly, Massachusetts to see how that district is starting to clean up its fleet.
In the one school bus lot in Beverly, about an hour north of Boston, driver Henry Berkemaus starts up one of the district's two electric school buses. After the initial beeping stops, a green light on the dashboard tells Berkemaus that he can hit the accelerator.
It operates the same as any other bus. The thing is, it drives sort of like a golf cart.
This engine sound, or lack thereof, is one of the first things you notice about these buses, especially compared to one of the diesel buses in the lot. The electric buses look just like the standard yellow ones that run on diesel or gasoline, except for the black lettering on the hood that says high voltage. They're 60% more fuel efficient and much better for the health of the staff and kids. Dana Cruikshank, the transportation director at Beverly Public Schools, knows firsthand how intense the exhaust can be in the bus lot.
Having all diesel buses there, I'm walking in and around all those running diesel buses, so I could really smell the fumes. There's no fumes on this bus at all.
Beverly Public Schools will get 3 more electric buses this spring, and officials there hope to transition all of the city's 27 buses by 2033. For the last 3 years, Beverly has been getting logistical and financial help from an electric transportation financing startup. It's called Highland Electric Fleets, and it happens to be down the street from the school district headquarters. Amy McGuire is the company's director of market development.
So we have about $250 million in investment capital at the moment, and that gives us a good amount of runway to go out and try to convince people that this is a good thing to do and now is the right time to do it.
The school district was a proof of concept for Highland after working mainly with smaller government vehicles. The company buys the buses and then leases them to the district for the same price that a diesel bus lease would cost. While this sounds like a money-losing prospect, McGuire says it's actually profitable because electric buses are about 30 to 50% cheaper to run and maintain. McGuire says it's a good long-term investment.
The more we can get electric school buses on the road, the more the market grows and the technology cost goes down.
In addition to Beverly, Highland Electric Fleets works with schools in about 30 other states and 3 Canadian provinces. And Highland has competition now from other startups. There's also a lot of government money at stake. Last summer, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it would give out $5 billion in grants as part of a clean school bus initiative. Laura Schifter is a senior fellow with the Aspen Institute.
So there's a lot of opportunity with federal investment right now to support school districts in transitioning to electric school buses.
Schifter adds that states and utilities are also helping out. California, for example, committed $122 million in subsidies last year. Colorado offered $65 million. And a handful of other states have subsidy programs in the works.
This is really going to spur a lot of action and help our school districts build the capacity with charging and, you know, help our workforce learn how to maintain and operate these buses.
Of the 480,000 school buses driving on U.S. roads, about 1% are electric. But production and delivery are speeding up. Every major bus manufacturer now offers an electric model, with many planning to increase their production this year. In Boston, I'm Kara Young for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I'll preface by saying I was thinking of maybe going to see a movie this weekend, but there's nothing really planned that I wouldn't rather just watch on my couch, which gets me to this. Regal Cinemas said this week it's going to close another 39 movie theaters across the country. They are multiplexes, to be sure, so it's way more than just 39 screens. And do not, by the way, suggest I go see Avatar 2 again. Just don't. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. They have been coming in relative drips and drabs for the past couple of days and weeks and months, really. But as the name of this last little bit of this program says, context is everything. So it's important to point out here that with the news from Alphabet today that it's going to cut 12,000 jobs, the American tech economy has now put more than 100,000 people out of work since the beginning of last year. That is the tally from the consulting company Challenger Gray and Christmas. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.